Much of the sermon was written under the influence of pain pills, muscle relaxants, and physical therapy. So there might be some unusual looking at 2 Samuel 2. But I have actually enjoyed spending some time looking at this passage. My back, despite my slightly stooped look, is about 10,000 times better than it's been, and it has stopped spasming, which is good. It's just locked up, and locked up is good when beat spasms all over the place. So, talking to Keith and Eric, this was a piece of cake compared to what their knees and hands feel like as they tile the house all week. So, anyway, your pastors have been a little bit out of shape, but we're back at it. As we look at 2 Samuel chapter 2, I want to kind of start off with some Eric-type question, because Eric always used to start his sermons with questions, and I always thought that was cool because he thinks of great questions, and I like his questions, and they always made me think. And so I'm going to try to ask an Eric-type question, and my Eric-type question for you tonight is, what is your ambition, and how far will you go to get it? What are the limits? What will you do to get what you want? How far will you go? And I kind of want you to think about that as we talk tonight and as we spend some time in 2 Samuel, because ambition is a good thing. You know, it helps us get out of bed in the morning. It gives us some purpose. Ambition can be a bad thing. It can destroy us. It can kill us. It can take us where we don't and ought not to be. And so, as you think about what it is you're ambitious to do, what it is that you desire to do, and I know that we often think of ambition in the area of job. You know, it's like, I'm going to get ahead in my job, or I'm going to, you know, whatever. I don't want to limit ambition at all to your job. Matter of fact, that's only a very small portion of ambition. I want you to think about ambition not just about your job, but your ambition in relationships, your ambition in the community, your ambition in just the personal desires, the things that you long for in your life. What are your ambitions? Now, for some of us, or for most of us, probably there are just a whole slew of those things. We have a lot of things we're ambitious about, and that's okay, because I want you to think about those things that you're ambitious about as we talk. And I'm going to just go ahead and read 2 Samuel chapter 2. David anointed king over Judah. In the course of time, David inquired of the Lord, "Shall I go up to one of the towns of Judah?" he asked. The Lord said, "Go up." David asked, "Where shall I go?" "To Hebron," the Lord answered. So David went up there with his two wives, Ahinoam of Jezreel and Abigail, the widow of Nabal of Carmel. David also took the men who were with him, each with his family, and they settled in Hebron and its towns. Then the men of Judah came to Hebron, and there they anointed David king over the house of Judah. When David was told that it was the men of Jabesh-Gilead who had buried Saul, he sent messengers to the men of Jabesh-Gilead to say to them, "The Lord bless you for showing this kindness to Saul your master by burying him. May the Lord now show you kindness and faithfulness, and I too will show you the same favor because you have done this. Now then, be strong and brave, for Saul your master is dead, and the house of Judah has anointed me king over them." Meanwhile, Abner, son of Ner, the commander of Saul's army, had taken Ishbosheth, son of Saul, and brought him over to Mahanaim. He made him king over Gilead. Ashurai and Jezreel, and also over Ephraim, Benjamin, and all Israel. Ishbosheth, son of Saul, was 40 years old when he became king over Israel, and he reigned 2 years. The house of Judah, however, followed David. The length of time David was king in Hebron over the house of Judah was 7 years and 6 months. Abner, son of Ner, together with the men of Ishbosheth, son of Saul, left Mahanaim and went to Gibeon. Joab, son of Zeruiah, and David's men went out and met them at the pool of Gibeon. One group sat down on one side of the pool, one group on the other side. Then Abner said to Joab, "Let's have some of the young men get up and fight hand to hand in front of us." "All right, let them do it," Joab said. So they stood up and were counted off, 12 men for Benjamin and Ishbosheth, son of Saul, and 12 for David. Then each man grabbed his opponent by the head and thrust his dagger into his opponent's side, and they fell down together. So that place in Gibeon was called Helkrath Hazurim. The battle that day was very fierce, and Abner and the men of Israel were defeated by David's men. The three sons of Zeruiah were there, Joab, Abishai, and Asahel, I can't read this. Anyway, all those wonderful names were in that part of the Bible. Anyway, now I'm going to have to get better glasses. Now Asahel was as fleet-footed as a wild gazelle. He chased Abner, turning neither to the right nor to the left as he pursued him. Abner looked behind him and asked, "Is that you, Asahel?" "It is," he answered. Then Abner said to him, "Turn aside to the right or to the left, take on one of the young men and strip him of his weapons." But Asahel would not stop chasing him. Again Abner warned Asahel, "Stop chasing me. Why should I strike you down? How could I look your brother Joab in the face?" But Asahel refused to give up the pursuit, so Abner thrust the butt of his spear into Asahel's stomach, and the spear came out through his back. He fell there and died on the spot. And every man stopped when he came to the place where Asahel had fallen and died. But Joab and Abishai pursued Abner, and as the sun was setting, they came to the hill of Ammah near Gaia on the way to the wasteland of Gibeon. Then the men of Benjamin rallied behind Abner. They formed themselves into a group and took their stand on top of a hill. Abner called out to Joab, "Must the sword devour forever? Don't you realize that this will end in bitterness? How long before you order your men to stop pursuing their brothers?" Joab answered, "As surely as God lives, if you had not spoken, the men would have continued the pursuit of their brothers until morning." So Joab blew the trumpet, and all the men came to a halt. They no longer pursued Israel, nor did they fight any more. All that night, Abner and his men marched through the Arabah. They crossed the Jordan, continued through the whole Bithron, and came to Mahanaim. Then Joab returned from pursuing Abner and assembled all his men. Beside Asahel, 19 of David's men were found missing, but David's men had killed 360 Benjamites who were with Abner. They took Asahel and buried him in his father's tomb at Bethlehem. Then Joab and his men marched all night and arrived at Hebron by daybreak. This is certainly one of the more brutal chapters that we'll read. And that brutality is huge. It's interesting that David starts out seeking God's will. If you'll recall, Samuel has anointed David as king. But to be anointed by the priest said that this was God's anointed one. But now the people have to accept him. Now the people have to put their blessing on him. And already we see this split. What's interesting to me is the split happens between really two factions. And it's Abner and Ishbosheth, and it's David and Joab. Those are the two. Now, what we have to remember about Abner was that he was Saul's right-hand man. He was the commander of all of Saul's army. He was the great warrior for Saul. And so he knew David. He knew David intimately because David obviously ate at Saul's table, so did Abner. There was a lot of intimacy in these relationships. And it's interesting that Abner was Saul's cousin. And so it's sort of this in the family kind of thing where Saul, the previous king, had taken in his cousin, he had taken in his family, he had taken in people he trusted and surrounded himself with those people. And then at the same time, Joab and his two brothers are, if I can remember this, it's David's sister's relative somehow, I forget. But anyway, there's a relationship there too. So there's relationships on both sides, and there are family connections. There are family connections. So now Ishbosheth would not normally be the rightful next king. It would be Saul's oldest son. But what does Abner do? Abner, the general, the wise one, picks Ishbosheth, who is like the weakest son. He is like the last son. He's not the one who would be king at all, but he picks him because he can use him. I think a lot of us have those kinds of relationships in our lives of people who use us for their own purposes. And I think if we're honest about our ambition, sometimes it's easy for us to use people around us to get what we want, to get what we want. And what Abner wants is power. What Abner wants is the position that he's had. He wants to be second in command. His ambition is to be second in command. And he knows that Joab is close to David. He knows that he doesn't have that relationship that Joab has. Now, why does Joab have this special relationship with David? Well, that goes back to the wonderful cave of Adullam, which is like my favorite story in all of 1 Samuel, because it says in 1 Samuel that there was this cave when David was on the run from Saul, when Saul was trying to kill him. He and his family fled, and they went to this cave, the cave of Adullam, and there gathered all the people who were, let's see, what were the three things? It'll come to me. What? In debt, depressed, and one other one. What's the third one? Anyway, depressed, in debt, pardon me? Yeah, and so they're basically running from the king, and so who is David gathered around him in this cave? Oh, discontented. It's the discontented, the depressed, and the in debt, okay? So that's who David's gathered around him. Now, that's not the kind of people that you normally make an army of, you know, but that's what David did. And so, you know what? He has gone through hell and the cave of Adullam with Joab. Joab and his family are part of that family. They're part of that whole family connection that went to the cave to hide out. And now they've kind of come up through the ranks with David. So Abner knows that he has no chance of influencing that or having any effect there. And so what he does is he would be king himself. His ambition is to rule, to have power. And he's going to get it one way or the other. So he calls on Ishbosheth and makes him king. This would be kind of like, you know, a general coming back from the Iraq War and deciding who the president's going to be of the United States. It's along that same line. It's sort of, he becomes the power broker. He becomes the person who can make things happen. It's interesting that God has brought them to special places too. Hebron is a place, a special place, where it was the land that had been given to Caleb, the good spy who had come into Israel, and it was given to him as a special gift by God. And that's where Hebron was, and that's where David gathers, the place where the special gift was given. The other thing is where Ishbosheth and Abner are hanging out is a place that I think it was Jacob had called the Camp of God. He had named it the Camp of God. So they're both kind of putting themselves in this position of saying, we're in God's territory. We're God's special people. We're where God is. Have you always noticed that whenever like two basketball teams get together like for the finals and they're praying in the locker room, if they actually do that, and they both pray, you know, that God will be with them, and you kind of wonder what God's doing up in heaven going, I just can't decide, you know, I really like Arizona basketball, but, you know, man, those, you know, so like, we're all praying that God will be on our side, you know, and we're all just sort of assuming that he is on our side, because after all, we are who we are, and so God must be on our side, and we're in God's territory, and that's kind of the kind of thing that's going on here, that we assume that we're in God's territory, that we're the ones, and then everybody, therefore, who's not with us must be outside of God's territory, must be somewhere else, because we're the place where God is. And that's, again, one of those ambitious things that's being called out in Abner. He's very wise about where he's picking and how he's picking. He's surrounding himself with a weak man, with weak people, but he's putting himself in this position of being, as the movie title recently said, a big fish in a small pond. And there he has power. The other interesting thing about Ishbosheth is that he was a child of Saul later in life, when Saul had walked away from God. Matter of fact, his name was Esh-Baal, Baal, which is a son of the false god, the son of the idol that Israel had. You know, it was when Saul had gone into idol worship, he had had a child at that time, and he names him after Baal, the god of the surrounding community, the lesser god, you know, one of the god that God hates. he's kind of setting him up in this position of throne, on the throne, as against God's anointed one. So there really is a power play in the kingdom of God going on here, besides just the power play amongst the people. And I think it's important for us to remember that when we're in our own little power plays in our relationships, that the power play isn't just between us, that there are other kingdom ramifications, and that what we do here affects what happens in the other world, and what is done in the other world affects us. That we do not live without effect and affect on others. And so Abner is in this position now of trying to gain the kingdom himself. At least if he can't be king because he has no right to the throne, he's going to be in control of the guy who does have the throne. Ishbosheth. And Job comes and he's loyal to David, and now they come out and they meet around this pool, and the men of David are on one side and the men of Ishbosheth / Abner are on the other side, and Abner issues a challenge. And it sounds like kind of a small challenge. He says, let's have some of the young men get up and fight hand to hand in front of us. Let's have a wrestling match. Let's see who's toughest. Let's see who can win. You pick 12, we'll pick 12, the 12 will fight. Let's see who the winners are. The problem with that, and the problem with so often what we do in our relationships, is that it always starts off small like that. We're just going to have a wrestling match. We just have a little disagreement. We just have to show that we're stronger or smarter or tougher or better or wiser or fill in the blank. We have something to prove. We need to have a place of superiority. Our ambition rises up. We want to show that we got it, that we've got what it takes, and that the other one therefore doesn't. It's interesting how often we have to kick others down to put ourselves on the pedestal. How often we have to push people aside, put them in their place, which is under us, so that we can have power, so we can have position, so we can have status. I have to confess that seeking status has been a long ambition in my life. I intended to be the president of Charlie C. Jones Battery and Electric Company, and you know, for a while, come hell or high water, I was going to have that job. I was going to be the president of the company. When the owner had said to me, Rod, go back to school and get your degree and then come back and run this place for me, I took him seriously and I thought, boy, I have a chance and I'm going to do this thing. One way or the other, I am going to be the boss. I'm going to have that job. I'm going to have that office. I'm going to have that big old mahogany desk with that leather chair. I am going to have that. That's going to be me sitting there making decisions. I'm going to do that. So I went to school and I got my degree in business administration and I minored in accounting and I learned everything there was to learn about that business and I worked every angle in that business, and anytime there was a job that needed to be done, I did it. I didn't do it for any altruistic reasons. I didn't do it because I wanted to help out mankind. I didn't do it because I wanted to help people who needed auto parts because they had to get their car fixed. Nothing at all like that. I did it because I wanted status. I did it because I wanted position. I did it because I wanted people to look up to me, which, by the way, most people do, but not for that reason. And so, you know, we had that thing. You know, we had that in us. There's, in many of us, most of us, there is that desire to be better than something, better than someone. You know, it may be a big fish in a small pond, and some of our ponds may be really little, but we want to be a big fish in that pond. We want to have something. We want to have that respect. We want to have people look up to us. We want to have people know us. In Abner's case, he's willing to farm that out. He doesn't actually fight for himself. Abner doesn't say, hey, Joab, you and me, let's duke this out. Let's see who the best one is. Instead, let's get 12 young guys to fight for us. Have you done that in your ambition? Enlisted others to fight for you? We're pretty good at that. We're pretty subtle sometimes in doing that. We're afraid to fight the battle ourselves, so we get other people to fight for us. See, Abner has sort of a history of cowardice. Abner was one of the people who stood to the side way back when David was going to fight Goliath. You know, when Goliath was shouting his insults at Saul, we make this big thing about, well, Saul was a coward. Well, who was his general? Abner. Who was his chief general? Who was the number one guy? Abner. Abner didn't go out and fight Goliath. This little kid David went out and fought. And you know what? David has something against Abner, and Abner has something against David. What did David do? David snuck into the camp, walked past all the soldiers, walked past Abner, and took Saul's stuff, his sword, his things, his water. That story must just ring now in Abner's ears, his humiliation. Because then David goes out and stands and says, look what I got. Look, I could have killed you, Saul. Well, in the camp, Saul's in the middle. All the soldiers are around to protect the king. And closest to the king is his general, his security guard, his number one guy, his best warrior. You know, I want my best warrior by my side. So there's history between these two men. And that shame must burn in Abner's heart. I think it's interesting because, by the way, when they changed Ishbaal to Ishbosheth, there's a reason for that. Ishbaal was son of the idol, but Ishbosheth means son of shame. He was called the shamed one. How would you like to walk through your life with the name shame? And then your general, your guy that's put you on this throne, is ashamed of what has happened, of having looked bad. And he's vowed that no matter what, he's going to get even. He's going to get back. He's going to make it to the top. Shame. Shame is a driver in our ambition. If we've been shamed or we are ashamed, so often it becomes a driver in our ambition. Is it a driver in your ambition? Where you've been shamed? Where you felt shame? Where you don't dare go because you don't want them to laugh, make fun? What did David had this thing against Abner because back in 1 Samuel, he keeps telling Saul every time that he has this chance to kill Saul and doesn't, he keeps telling Saul, don't listen to the men around you who tell you that I am out to kill you. Don't listen to them. Who was telling Saul that David was out to kill him? You think his military advisors, his close friends, his cousins, Abner? So there's history here. There's, you know, it's always, our problem with ambition is it's always tied up with our relationships, our families, those closest to us. And that's where shame is tied up too, in all those things. These guys come out to this wrestling match, hand-to-hand combat. We're going to fight and see who's strongest. Except they all bring daggers, just in case the fight's going badly. They all bring that little extra thing that gives them the advantage, you know? Never bring a knife to a gunfight was the old rule in the West, you know? You're not in good shape, you know? If you're bringing a knife to a gunfight, not good. Bring a gun to a gunfight. So what happens is they're supposed to come to a wrestling match and instead they bring a dagger. And then they bring out the daggers and they all grab each other by the hair, which is probably by the beard, because they're starting to wrestle, and then they all stab each other at once, and then they all fall down dead. all 24 guys kill each other, which is like pretty miraculous, pretty weird, and pretty strange story. And when all that happens, immediately the two gangs go after each other. Joab's gang, Abner's gang. And the war goes on. It's interesting to me that big, huge canyons start from those little splits. You know, if you look back at that putting down of Abner by David, the sort of laughing at Abner that David did, that was just a little cut. And then that cut got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And now there's war, and it's going to get bigger yet. And pretty soon there's going to be two kingdoms, the kingdom of Israel and the kingdom of Judah. The split becomes so huge that it's not repairable. You can't fix it. Is your ambition doing that? Is your desire to succeed in some area, to get ahead in some area, does that do that to the people around you? Your family, people you love, people you're in relationship with? Do those little cracks, have they started and then they just start getting bigger and bigger and bigger? And then one day you wake up and you can't imagine how that chasm, that huge chasm got between you, that huge canyon came between you. So I want you to think tonight a little bit about some of those things that you've done that have started those splits. And think about why you did them. Almost always when we start looking at what has split us from other people, we look at what their fault is. Right? Joab's looking at Abner going, hey, you started it. Whose suggestion was this to have these guys fight? Right? I didn't suggest it. You suggested it. You started it. Boy, we're big on that. We always got to know who started it. Whose fault is it? If we can just get whose fault it is, then we can go kick them to the curb. You know? But we got to figure out whose fault it is. But in every one of these splits, there's always plenty of fault to go around. Whenever we sit down and there's a couple that are going to get married next week, and they had asked me to do their wedding, and you know, you sit down with them and you do the whole premarital talk through and counseling kind of thing, and it's really fun because, you know, have you had a good fight is always one of my questions. Because I don't want to marry you unless you've had a good fight, you know? Unless you've had a knockdown, drag out, screaming, hollering, ranting, raving, whatever, however it is you fight, I don't want to marry you unless you've had a good fight. Unless you really have walked through that fight, come out on the other side, and you still like each other. Because you don't even like really know each other until you've done that. You think you do, but you don't. And if you think you're never going to have a fight, boy, do you have problems. And for sure, I'm not going to marry you. So, you know, it's just, you know, I want to know that. But then I also want to know, what was it about? What was the split? And it's always funny because it's always a he said, no, she said, well, no, but that was because you did. No, but that was because you did that. And that's where the whole blame game starts. And that's what Job and Abner are already doing. It's Job is already thinking and saying, you know what, you started this. It's your fault. And then they pursue. The battle starts. One side's getting beaten, and when you get beaten, you run. And when you run, they don't stop. They keep coming. And Joab's brother It's his little brother, by the way. You know, little brother is trying to prove himself, trying to be the same man that his older brother Joab is. And matter of fact, his other older brother once is noted in Scripture for having killed 300 men in a battle, in battle. So clearly, this is the young brother of two heroes, two great warriors. Think he has something to live up to? Think he wants to prove himself? Think he's got some ambition? If I kill Abner, if I come back with Abner's armor, because I got him, boy, then I'll be somebody. Then I'll be noticed. Then people will look up to me. Then they'll respect me. And so he runs, and he runs, and he runs. And Abner says, stop already. Because Abner knows, Abner is older, wiser, a formidable warrior, a huge, strong man. He's got skills that this younger brother doesn't have of Joab. And so he tells him, he warns him, stop. I don't want to fight you. Go fight some young guy, you know? Go take somebody else's armor. Just keeps running. Keeps running. Job warns him again. Abner warns him again. Stop. Stop already. Turn away. Go to the right. Go to the left. I don't know. Stop following me. Keeps running. Keep running. And what does Abner finally do? He takes his spear and he just tries to stop him. He pushes back with his spear. He doesn't turn around and stab him. He stabs him with the blunt end of his spear. And he is such a powerful man that it goes all the way through and kills him. And that's where war begins. I'm just trying to stop him from doing the thing that he's doing. I don't mean to kill him. I don't mean to make this bigger than it is. I just want to stop you. Just knock it off. How about in your relationships? Have you done that to people? Oh, you didn't intend to hurt them. You didn't intend to run them through. You were just trying to get them off your back. Just get them away. Just turn to the right, turn to the left, turn some way. Just get away from me. Just stop it. And we cause pain. And the rifts happen. There's a rift, a huge rift between God and man. A canyon, a chasm, a space so huge that it can't be crossed. And it started because somebody took some fruit, forbidden fruit, and ate it. Small act, really. Not that big a deal. And changes all of history. And that little defiant act breeds death. And God, in the position of power, loves us and makes a way through that chasm, crosses that canyon, and does that by sending Jesus to be one of us and to live with the only ambition, his only ambition, to save us, to live and offer his life for us. I don't know how Job and Abner could have resolved it. I thought about that a lot. I know how they temporarily resolved it. Abner got up on a hill, surrounded himself with the soldiers. It was a pretty impenetrable position. It's a position of power. Joab knows he's going to lose a lot more men. And they appealed to something that I think is kind of interesting. They appealed to brotherhood. Somewhere in there, they remembered they were brothers. If they trace their lineage back, they have a common father. They have something in common. And when they look back at what they have in common, they stop fighting. Unfortunately, they only stop fighting for a while. I don't know where your ambition has taken you, and I don't know the damage that's left in your wake. I know that there's much in mine, and I'm sure there's much in yours, all of ours. But as you think of the people that you've hurt and that have hurt you, and the damage that's been done, I wonder what it would be like to remember that you're family. I wonder what it would be to remember what it would be like to have it be right. And begin to live with that dream. It's going to be tough to make it a reality. I know a lot of your stories. The relationships are so broken and so screwed up. And their ambition and your own has conspired to kill any hope for future. But I wonder what it would be like if we could remember what we were supposed to be. And if we could begin to work and speak towards that. And if we could begin to dream and imagine what that could be like. And if we could lay aside our ambition to be noticed, to be something, to be somebody, to have position, power, authority, wealth, status. If we could lay that aside and allow God to give that to us if He desires, or take it away if He desires, if it wouldn't run our lives, if it would just be good when He gave us good things, but not be necessary. We talk a lot about desires of our hearts being good, but how quickly we turn desires into demands. What desires, longings, deep longings do you have that you've turned into demands, that you've made an ambition? Let's pray. Father, we